This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fritke, and these are the stories you don't want to miss. For the week of February 13th, here are some top stories. This week, an Arizona power company announced it would shut down a northern Arizona coal-fired power plant in 3 years. That's 25 years earlier than the Navajo Nation anticipated. While environmentalists celebrate the closure, hundreds of Navajo people who rely on those jobs are devastated. From the Fronteras Desk in Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
When Marlene Fowler wakes up in Caibito, 30 miles south of Page, she can see a yellow-green haze on the horizon. But Fowler's not worried about the pollution. It's her husband's job at the Navajo Generating Station that has her in a panic.
Hopefully it doesn't shut down. even though they say the pollution is all this and that, but it's been there years, you know. I'm doing biscuits and gravy for the community seniors.
Fowler gets $10 an hour as a cook for the senior center, but it's her husband's paycheck the family depends on. He's a part-time mechanic for the power plant. Fowler says without the plant work, he'll have to travel to various odd jobs.
He has to be here with his kids, and, you know, it's going to cost a lot of gas and mileage on the vehicles. We don't have transportation for him to go out to job sites. They have to pay their motels and meals and lodging and stuff.
Outside the kitchen, Lorinda Bennett and her husband, who's retired from the plant, sit on the senior center couch waiting for biscuits and gravy.
I have two boys and three girls and a lot of grandkids. I have a daughter that's working there and two son-in-laws working there. They're close by. We see them almost every day.
Bennett worries the plant shutdown will take her children and grandkids far away.
Our kids are going to move away and our grandkids. And, you know, that's what they're planning on if they're already looking for another job.
The Navajo Nation has relied on the coal industry for the last four decades. The industry and energy companies have provided hundreds of families with five-figure salaries. 90% of the power plant employees are Navajo. The revenue, taxes, and royalties all make up about a third of the tribe's operating budget and the majority of the Hopi tribe's budget. The Salt River Project and other plant owners say natural gas is much cheaper and makes more economic sense. A plant closure means the coal mine that feeds the plant would also likely shut down. Many compare the Navajo Nation to a developing country, with 50% unemployment and increasing violent crime. There's one police officer for every 130 square miles on the sprawling reservation. Joanne Sakoti is Caibito's community service coordinator.
Crimes and people hurting one another is already here.
With more Navajos out of work, Sakoti worries about more people turning to a life of crime.
I know it's going to affect everyone. It's going to traumatize everyone because everyone's going to think that this is it. So everyone needs to just get out of their comfort zone and go back to school.
Coconino County Supervisor Lena Fowler agrees. Fowler has been trying to bring together three colleges from the region to build an education center in Page. She wants to give power plant employees a reason to stay.
These are the homeowners. These are the people that come and shop. If that dollar flow is not there, where are we going to get that? We don't want to see businesses' doors close.
Fowler started work on an economic impact plan when she thought she had 25 years to prepare.
How do we help ourselves? How do we help our children? How do we help our neighbors? How do we as a community come together to help each other to keep our population whole and families whole?
The Salt River Project is talking to the Navajo Nation about jobs needed to dismantle and clean up the plant. The tribe is also planning to recruit new businesses to the reservation. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
The Phoenix City Council denied a citizen request this week to designate Phoenix a, quote, sanctuary city. This is as local governments across the U.S. have been debating whether to continue offering safe haven to undocumented immigrants. South of the border, Mexico City is implementing sanctuary city policies of its own. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Jorge Valencia reports.
Mauricio Quesada is pointing at a poster. He's sharing his personal story with his classmates, almost all of whom migrated from Central America to Mexico City. Quesada was a social studies teacher in El Salvador, and every week he traveled 4 hours to his job.
When I came home one weekend, my wife told me that someone had been coming over at night and had been leaving envelopes under the door. They wanted me to pay them $150 every 2 weeks.
The envelopes were signed by the gang MS-13. Quesada made a relatively good living of $750 per month. He was able to pay for a while, but he was the only breadwinner for his wife, his two sons, and his grandson. When he started leaving the gang $85 or $75, they started following him.
You started seeing two individuals on bicycles. And when I crossed the street, they would be right behind me. They didn't do anything to me at that moment, but they were trying to make me scared and panic.
Quesada was worried about his family. So last summer, his wife and kids moved to his in-law's house, and he left to look for work in Mexico. Authorities here denied him his asylum application, saying he had no evidence of his hardship. To which he said, what more evidence than being 50 years old and leaving a good job that paid well?
For evidence, maybe I should have come without an arm or with two bullet wounds on my chest. Maybe that would be enough evidence. I came to Mexico only because I'm looking for a safe place for my family. That's my only goal.
Mexico received almost 9,000 asylum applications last year, and the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees expects that number to more than double this year, in part because the U.S. has become less appealing. Within Mexico, the capital city has become a destination itself. It has policies that resemble those of American sanctuary cities. City officials say they don't report people's immigration status to the federal government. Also, Mexico City is the only local government in the country that issues ID cards to migrants. This gives them access to public health services. And the city gives migrants money to help them start their own businesses. In 2015, the city funded more than 350 projects. Rubén Fuentes Rodríguez heads Mexico City's program for migrants.
Migrants, regardless of their nationality, are not prosecuted in Mexico City, at least not by our office. Our role is to help them.
These policies are a result of a law from 2011 that made Mexico City what officials here call a hospitable city for migrants. Elisa Ortega Velázquez does migration research at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. She says Mexico City is the only city in the country that is offering services to immigrants.
It's been about 20 years that Mexico City is governed by left, which is keen to provide citizens with some rights, such as gay marriage and abortion.
And yet, many advocates complain that migrants often don't get the services that the law affords them, or that some local officials do report them to federal immigration authorities. Gabriela Hernandez runs a shelter for adult men.
There are two speeches. There's the one that the mayor gives, and there's the one that his public servants give.
Servidores públicos.
Hernandez says she gives the mayor the benefit of the doubt. She says she believes he wants to help, but just lacks follow-through.
I think we should work on making this a sanctuary city, but we should work on actually getting things done, not just on politicians saying they're doing them.
Mauricio Quesada, the teacher from El Salvador, is participating in a class that can make him eligible for the city's business grant program. For his presentation, he drew a mountain with a big sun shining above.
The moral is that there's a long road left to travel and little time to rest. I can't stop walking until I see the clarity of the sun.
But Quesada's needs are immediate, and the city's grant program won't deliver until July at the earliest. He says he recently got a job as a carpenter, but that he still hasn't collected enough money to send his family. Jorge Valencia, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
You're listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Let's give a listen to this from our original program, The Show.
If you somehow haven't gotten the big red and pink memo, Valentine's Day is tomorrow. You can send your Valentine chocolates or roses or a card.
Or how about all of that plus live music?
Is that something I get at the grocery store?
No, but every Valentine's Day, a local chorus group divides its members into sets of barbershop quartets and ships them out across the valley to surprise and sometimes confuse people who they're sent to. They shared some of those stories with the show's Annika Klein.
E flat.
If you hear this, it might be a sign you're about to be serenaded.
Close your eyes and I kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you.
And for about $50, these dulcet tones are actually deliverable. It's something the Phoenicians Chorus offers as a Valentine's special. Send all your loving via four guys in red vests.
All my loving I will send to you. All my loving, darling.
Well, it certainly is a surprise to most.
That's Dan Ryan, the baritone of the quartet you just heard.
One of the most interesting times was where we were invited out to meet the couple at a macaroni grill. And the guy had set it up with the family of his girlfriend and his own parents, and he got down on one knee and proposed. And you can imagine the whole restaurant stopped what it was doing. And, of course, they erupted into cheering. She starts bawling, and luckily, she said yes.
All my loving, darling, I'll be true.
But, just like love, the gigs can sometimes get a little wild and reckless. Lead singer Kurt Streich remembers singing to one woman in her cubicle.
Of course, all the other people stopped what they were doing and gathered around, and there was this guy on the next cubicle, climbed up over the top of it to take a picture of everything. And what he didn't realize was there was a ceiling fan going right above him. And this hit him in the head. It didn't hurt him, but there was a lot of dust and debris on this fan that just went flying all over the place. And we couldn't finish the song. We were laughing so hard.
And then, of course, there was the time they sang to a very embarrassed desk sergeant at the Phoenix Police Department, right in front of his officers. They never know what the next visit will be like. Jay Bartley, the tenor, says sometimes they get people who don't want to face the music, like in this visit last year.
A fella had scrimped and saved and put his money together to get his girlfriend, Rose, and a couple of songs. And he gave us the address, and as we got closer, it says, it's a laundromat. And she was dressed, as you would, in a laundromat. And normally, like you hear all the stories about, she'd break down and cry. This particular young lady became very angry and started cussing at us and kicked us out of the laundromat. So we were the ones that got surprised.
For more than a decade, they've set out to spread the love, and they say it's worth it for the really heartwarming moments, like when bass singer Don Kainline sang at a couple's 50th anniversary.
They're just celebrating at Safeway in the cake department, and they're just having their cake and coffee, and we're singing to them, and just tears are coming out. It's very emotional and very rewarding for us.
I can forget you never. From you I ne'er can sever.
So I had to ask, after a day of sending other people's love, what do the guys do with their own Valentines? Here's Kurt Streich again.
My wife is used to being by herself on Valentine's Day, and I usually am able to confiscate a few extra roses from the day, or if we have time, to arrange for the quartet to sing for my wife.
Which would not be a surprise to her. Just a nice touch. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
In business news, the Valley of the Sun could become the Valley of the Censors under a global investment plan unveiled this week. From the KJZZ Business Desk, Christina Estes reports the Greater Phoenix Economic Council wants to position the Valley as a leader in the Internet of Things and sensor technology applications.
In simple terms, sensors detect changes and send information to computers, while the Internet of Things relates to anything with an on and off switch that connects to the Internet. GPEC President and CEO Chris Camacho says legacy industries like aerospace and defense and microelectronics will help position the Valley as an emerging sensor hub.
You know, we have so much of this, ongoing, already invested in our market, and yet
you know, the global markets are unaware. So our goal is to raise the reputation, raise the notoriety of the great things already happening in Greater Phoenix, at the same time using that as a lever point to then bring new investment and to complement the existing supply chains that do exist.
The plan, which includes marketing campaigns, will focus on attracting companies from Taiwan, China, Germany, and the United Kingdom. It's part of the Global Cities Initiative through the Brookings Institution. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Researchers in genetics labs perform many tasks, from extracting DNA to conducting diagnostic tests. But over the past few decades, many labs have been adding another, more humble chore to that list, feeding the fish. From the Arizona Science Desk, KJZZ's Nicholas Gerbis reports.
When budding bioscientists plan their futures, they probably don't picture themselves feeding sea monkeys to a bunch of freshwater minnows. But in a small room near the lab benches of the Translational Genomics Research Institute, or TGen, that's exactly what John Collins does.
They're fed twice with brine shrimp and once with flake food.
Well, that's not all he does.
I'm a research associate in Dr. Hyung Han's lab, and I work on pancreatic cancer.
These 50 tanks hold about 700 zebrafish. Over the past half century, these tiny fish have made a big splash in research, ranging from cancer to neurological disorders. So, why are they so valued?
They have transparent scales, especially early on, and we can actually introduce a mutation that completely gets rid of that pigmentation.
Imagine lab rats that you can see through to watch tumors grow or to watch brains develop. Now, imagine they're cheap, hardy, and breed like bunnies on Viagra.
A single male and female can produce hundreds of fertilized eggs, and they mature very quickly.
This sped-up life cycle doesn't just let TGen crank out new strains quickly. It means other processes occur in fast-forward, too.
For our pancreatic cancer model, we can significantly compress the time that it takes for tumors to develop.
So what do fish tumors have to do with us? Well, according to lab director Hyung Han, humans share about 70% of their genes with zebrafish. As vertebrates, we share the same basic organs, including a pancreas. And more to the point,
you look at the pathology, you know, under the microscope, you see that the tumor is very similar to the human tumor.
To cause those tumors, Han's lab tweaks the zebrafish's DNA, adding a cancer-causing gene here, knocking out a tumor suppressor gene there. Sometimes they add other disorders, too.
What we're trying to see is that different disorders, how they can, you know, affect cancers.
Elsewhere, in TGen's Center for Rare Childhood Disorders, Sampath Rangasamy uses zebrafish embryos to study epileptic encephalopathies, childhood brain disorders that cause seizures, mental deficits, and sometimes death.
You can see infantile patients and epileptic seizures in the children as early as 2 months old, 6 months old.
Rangasamy's team believed that one patient's epilepsy was caused by a mutated gene. They were right. Muting that gene in zebrafish caused seizures within 72 hours. It was an exciting finding because
we can use it for further studies. We can use this model to screen for drugs.
Arizona State University has used zebrafish to test immune responses to nanomaterials. Northern Arizona University has used them to study arsenic's effects on breast cancer treatment. At the University of Arizona Cancer Center, they've helped researchers seek treatments for chemotherapy-related hearing loss.
Every university, if they have good biology departments, they usually have fish facilities, not just zebrafish, some other, you know, fish types as well.
For all that we hear about big data and computer models, they have yet to replace living model species. Until they do, well, somebody's got to feed those fish. Nicholas Gerbis, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the ASU Biodesign Institute, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischmann, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fritke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information source.